Advised.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, October 28th, 2020, and thank you for joining us for the 95th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show until around midnight at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Most of the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Goodness, you were right. That's a naughty one. Okay, so thank you for that. And if you wouldn't mind, please, for those of our listeners who didn't quite catch the joke, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic, if you would.
Absolutely. So for those 80s freaks, that was a song by The Vapors calling Turning Japanese. And the reason I chose it, well, since one of these syndromes tonight we're going to be talking about, a phenomena we're going to be talking about related to people who choose to be alone by choice, is the hikikomori syndrome or phenomena. And so since that's obviously Japanese, I thought this would be kind of a cute nod to that.
So you chose the clean version. I thought you were being exceptionally naughty. Because as we were talking about
not yet, but I can
alone,
be.
and there are urban legends amongst the rock and roll circuit that that song was about things that one might do when one is alone.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, as Dr. Mathis mentions much more cleanly, tonight's episode is entitled Alone, Loner Behavior and Reclusiveness, which we will discuss in a moment in detail. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay. So what I've been doing recently, as you know, has been giving homages to various people and scenarios. So tonight I thought I'd do kind of a twist on that. And while I have given homages to individual percussionists, I thought tonight I would do a shout out and talk about singing drummers, which is a lot more common than most people recognize. And before we get into this, I'm just going to do make this kind of brief disclaimer that these are drummers who actually sing while playing drums, not some of the people who used to play drums and then picked up a guitar and started singing, or who sing when they're not behind the drum kit, whether it's vocal lead vocals or harmony vocals. So these are genuine guys and gals who do it simultaneously. So they are singing.
Oh, God, we're going to be 12 years old tonight, listeners. That's okay. That's how it goes.
Yes. And that's different from when. Yeah. So these are these are folks who actually do vocals, either lead and or background vocals, while doing their percussion thing. So here we go. And some of these you're going to go, oh, yeah, I know a few of the guys and gals he's going to talk about. Yep, you probably do, but I guarantee that there are going to be folks you're going to go, who the heck is that? Or, oh my gosh, I forgot about that. Or, that person sings too. And of course, yes, that is the correct response. So, these are all listed in alphabetical order. Yeah, what else would a compulsive guy do, right? And so that way I'm not giving preference to any group or performer. These are not listed in order of my personal preference. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, some of these drummers play for bands or that I have no interest in whatsoever. No offense to those folks. But be that as it may, they certainly have my admiration to be able to do that and sing at the same time. So here we go. And some of these I may or not may not pronounce correctly. So I'll ask the artist herself or himself my apologies before I even go there. Okay, so the first one is Rimu Altonen, and that's one of the ones I was like going, I don't know if I'm going to get this right or not. And that drummer plays for the band Hurricanes, which I thought was very cute. Isn't that cute? So the next one is Steven Ansell that plays for a band called Blood Red Shoes. The next one is Phoenix Arnhorn, plays for a band called Courage My Love. The next one is Chris Czar, which plays for a band called Autolux. And this one is somebody that you folks might have heard of, Ginger Baker, who played for Cream.
Yeah,
who did mostly background stuff, but actually did sing one Cream song that they did live, Pressed Rat and Warthog, which is actually more of a recital, but still. Matt Beeler for the band Exciter, I think a Canadian band. Terry Bozzio, who started out with Frank Zappa and then with his own band, Missing Persons. Brewer of Grand Funk Railroad. So for those people who go, oh, wait a minute, I thought Mark Farner was the lead singer for them. Yep, he was, but Don Brewer also did a lot of lead vocals, including the song We're an American Band. Yeah.
Really?
So, Mike... Oh, yeah, that's Don Brewer. Oh,
while
yeah,
drumming.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Wow,
and having seen them
impressive.
In concert as a kid. Yeah, and having seen them as a kid in concert, I can absolutely guarantee you that's what happened. Mike Browning from Morbid Angel. Mm-hmm. Albert Bouchard for a band a lot of people know, Blue Oyster Cult.
Yep.
Matt Cameron for Pearl Jam. Karen Carpenter for obviously The Carpenters, although at some point she stepped away from the drums to lead vocals, but she's actually a pretty competent drummer. She didn't do that much with The Carpenters because of the nature of the music, but she's actually was actually a pretty skilled percussionist.
Because her brother was the drummer for The Carpenters, because Cubby.
No, drummer was the composer pianist.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, absolutely. Eric Carr for Kiss.
Oh, yeah.
Replaced really and very accomplished drummer. Here's one people are not going to know. Dean Castronovo, who played with Bad English and is now playing with Journey. And having seen him with Journey live, I can tell you he's got an amazing voice that sounds almost identical to Steve Perry. I don't know why. And no offense to Arnell, the guy they got lead singing now, the Filipino guy, the guy who's fabulous. Dean's got a killer voice. I was like, holy moly. Will Champion. Yeah, I know. Who'd have thunk it? Will Champion from Coldplay. Here's when everybody's going to know the band, but they're going to go, oh, I thought that was the lead singer. Well, yeah, he was, but he's also the drummer. Dave Clark for the Dave Clark Five.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. That one took me by surprise, too, I have to admit. Phil Collins for Genesis.
Of course. I expected that one to be on the list. I was making sure.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Stuart Copeland for The Police. Carolyn Carr Carolyn Corr for The Corrs. Yeah, what a shock. Peter Criss, the original drummer for Kiss. Bron Daler for Mastodon. Mickey Dolenz for the Monkees, and did play drums. Nick D. Virgio for Spock's Beard. I always love that name of that band. That's taken from the Star Trek episode where Spock, they go into a parallel universe and the evil Spock has got a beard. Great episode. If you're a Star Trek person. I am.
I literally just watched that last week. I've been binging the original series.
I love those. But of course, I'm a nerd, so, Deuce for the Mentors. Ed Deuce for the Mentors. Sheila E. for Prince and for her solo project. Right. I mean, that's because, her uncle, I think it was her uncle, was one of the original percussionists for Carlos Santana. So, what a shock that is.
So she comes by it honest.
Yeah, exactly. It runs in the family. A lot of her relatives are percussionists. Nick Gaffney for Cairo Knife Fight, which is a great name for a band. Never heard of them, but hey.
That's awesome.
John Garner for Sir Lord Baltimore, another great band for a name for a band. Jerry Gaskell for King's X, as most people think of King's X as the bass player that does the lead vocals, but they all three of them do lead vocals, and they're all really, they get great harmonies and all really good vocalists. Aaron Gillespie for Under Oath, Sebastian Grainer for Death from Above 1979. That is a very strange band. Taylor Hawkins for the Foo. Well, for a guy who's much more, I'm way too traditional for that. I'm not saying they're bad. I'm saying they're different. Taylor Hawkins for Foo Fighters. Grant Hart for Husker Du. Helders. Right. Mark Helders for the Arctic Monkeys, another band that's way too out for me. Limon Helm from the band. Right, The Night They Drove Dixie Down. That's Limon Helm. Yeah.
Nice.
Even though he didn't write it, he sings it. Peter Horlbeek from Rare Earth. The one everybody's going to know, Don Henley from the Eagles. Duncan from a band called Snuff, and there is no way I'm going to get this one right, but Na Kawakita from Maxim the Hormone. It's like, what? Already then. Kelly Kagi from Night Ranger.
Nice.
Right, who sings Sister Christian and a lot of their hits. Okay. Fred LeBlanc from Cowboy Mouth. Jen Ledger from the Christian rock band Skillet. Mark Mayer from Spider Bait, Black Betty. the original Black Betty. Yeah. Stephanie Menerts from Brutus. Leo Marguerite from Pain of Salvation. Francis Mark from Autumns to Ashes. That's the name of the band. Donovan Malero from Hail the Sun, one that everybody should know if they don't. Buddy Miles, who started out as the original drummer for the Electric Flag and then went to play with a person you might have heard of, Jimi Hendrix, in the band of Gypsies, and then to a solo career. Buddy Miles is the guy that sings and wrote Them Changes.
Okay.
Gil Moore from Triumph. Mm-hmm. Anderson Pete Pack, who does a solo stuff. Mike Portnoy from Dream Theater, The Winery Dogs, and Sons of Apollo. And Winery Dogs are, if folks out there haven't heard Winery Dogs, they kick patooties. They are really awesome. Not the Dream Theater sucks or the Sons of Apollo's bad either, but Winery Dogs is very much up my alley. Chris Rayford for Autopsy. Jurgen Reel from Creator. The Rev, who unfortunately is no longer with us, original guy with Avenged Sevenfold. Morgan Rust from Seven Dust. Brandon Saylor from Atreyu. Greg Santier from Deerhoof. The one that everybody, the first one out of everybody's mouth, Ringo Starr from the Beatles.
Nice.
Yeah. Barry Stern from Zoetrope. Andy Sturmer from Jellyfish. Yeah. Andy Sturmer from Jellyfish. Another one everybody should know if they don't. Roger Taylor for Queen. He's got a really good voice. He's got sing, in addition to all the harmonies, he's the guy that sang, among other things, I'm in Love with My Car.
I love that song. Nobody knew where it was. You know, I have the original album somewhere now.
I mean, that's a Roger Taylor song, and he sings it. Got a feel for my automobile.
Yeah.
I love it. That's a great tune. Pat Torpe from Mr. Big. Who I don't think is with anymore either. Maya Tuttle from The Colorist, obviously a British band because it's spelled Colorist, you know. Meg White from The White Stripes, Cody Willis from The Melvins, and somebody you will definitely know who unfortunately is also not with us anymore, Dennis Wilson from The Beach Boys.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go. That's my list of
sanctuary. If you did say this, I've missed it, but I know you mentioned Phil Collins. But going back to Genesis, did Peter Gabriel sing when he was drumming with them? Because I know he's a singer.
Yeah, and when Peter Gabriel left, Phil Collins took over.
Right. But was Peter also a singing drummer or not? Because I would have expected he was, but I don't remember that you named him.
No, he was just lead vocalist for them. He wasn't playing drums for them.
Oh, I see.
All he did was he was a front man. I'm not suggesting that's, you know, an easy job, but he was a front man for them.
Okay, so even though he does drums, he wasn't doing it for them at that time.
Nor does he play drums and sing at the same time, correct.
Gotcha, okay. All right.
Yeah,
well,
he's a percussionist. He just doesn't play and sing at the same time. Right.
Right, gotcha. Okay, so we've cleared that up.
Which is why I didn't list Dave Grohl. Right, which is why I didn't list Dave Grohl, because he was really a drummer for Nirvana, but he didn't sing for Nirvana, and now he's a guitar player for Foo Fighters. He doesn't play drums. So that's why I didn't name him.
Gotcha. Okay. Yes, that's a very distinct line we're drawing tonight, and that's kind of interesting. And it's kind of fun to see who knows how but wasn't playing at certain times. That's kind of an interesting career choice.
Absolutely. One would have not guessed. I would have not guessed that. That's for Dag, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I guess wanted to. Yeah. Whatever. Whatever floats your boat, I'm good with that.
Cool.
So anyway, that's my list. Let's stick to it.
Okay. Well, that was really fascinating. I think this is one of my favorite trivia, so thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Lots of new stuff that we learned tonight. Okay, drum class. So, Thank you. And again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening and for the rest of the hour until around midnight. Feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All right, I have a quick clip for you guys relative to tonight's topic that I would like to play for you. It's very short.
And the night goes by so very slow. Oh, I hope that it won't end, though.
And unfortunately, I cut it for the fun part. I really love that song. It's actually one of my signature repertoire that I pull out for karaoke because I really love to do that song. It's a lot of fun. But tonight's topic is alone, loner behavior, and reclusiveness. So by request of a couple of our followers, these were actually two or three separate topics that I have merged together. Tonight's topic is about comparing and discussing varying forms of loner and reclusive behavior for a variety of reasons. The original request topics were agoraphobia and hikikomori. And we will tell you guys what both of those are. Most people know agoraphobia. I didn't know what hikikomori was, and most people do not, but we'll get to that in a second. So with the 2020 quarantine still in effect, and likely to remain so for several months still, the majority of us are living a somewhat modified but still fairly reclusive lifestyle these days. However, there are several subsets of people who were previously already living in this manner for any one of several reasons. Some people are shy, introverted, misanthropic, or may even be depressed or grieving. Some may have a mental health condition that affects their socialization. Some are slow to mature and become independent, and are in a so-called, quote, failure to launch scenario, you know, from the movie, still living with their parents. Some have physiological health issues that necessitate their limiting their contact with others, such as people who are immunocompromised. Tonight, we will look at multiple situations that can cause adults to live as recluses or loners. Tonight, we will discuss an overview of reclusiveness, loners by choice, loners by pathology, and resources for those struggling with social disconnect. Now, typically we have a loose format to our show, and I did separate things into sections, but despite having a list of segments for discussion, tonight's information may be lumped mostly together as one big one, as this behavior seems to be difficult to fully separate into distinct categories. Truth be told, being a loner or being reclusive is more of a symptom than it is a pathology or anything else. So it's very difficult to break it down fully scientifically with XYZ as the cause and so forth. This doesn't break down that way, but it is a mental health and wellness topic, and a lot of people have been asking for various parts of this. So we wanted to be able to give that to you guys. So before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything specific you want to slip in before we get started.
Nope, I'm good.
Alrighty. So, living in seclusion with little or no contact with the outside world is a situation that could have myriad reasons or causes. There's a significant spectrum of types of loner behavior and reclusiveness, and we will discuss several of them and their distinct differences this evening. While we have different sections for discussion on situations that are choices versus situations that come from a pathology or a mental health issue or personal circumstances, in the process of researching for this show, it became apparent to me that a majority of causes have elements that could be in either category or occasionally both. We will list causes by what is the primary or majority assumption, whether it's a choice or a pathology. I'm going to stop here and see, Dr. Mathis, do you have anything that you want to add to this concept before we keep going?
No, I'm good, except I just would say that, you know, there are people who just prefer to be by themselves, you know, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with them, quote unquote. They just don't require a lot of social interaction and prefer, you know, their own company to that of others for the most part.
Yes. That we are definitely going to talk about that a couple of times tonight. And That is definitely a thing. We are not making a judgment call or an inference that simply wanting to be by yourself is always pathological. And that's
I call it the Greta Garbo syndrome.
Well, you know what's interesting?
Because
she
wants to be alone.
in spite of that famous line, there's a page that was like, you know, famous introverts and famous, you know, people that live, you know, loners. And she actually was not as much of a loner as she was reputed to be, it turns out. You know, she was somewhat reclusive, but not – people actually thought she was like Howard Hughes level, like never comes out hardly. And turns out that actually – bit of a myth, you know, the mystique of it, I think, helped her career. So they let that go. Plus, they didn't have the internet to say, liar, liar, pants on fire.
she wasn't a hermit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there are some people who are, and we will talk about some positive examples of that behavior tonight, because, like I said, you know, we're not painting this all as pathological or even an inappropriate choice. We're just looking at all the choices and their differences here. Some of these terms that we're using tonight, people use interchangeably, and that's technically not actually correct for a few of them. So we'll get into that part too. Okay, so the next section I have listed as loner by choice, but as I mentioned earlier, when looking a lot of these up, there was such a mix of things that I'm not being real strict about the boundaries. So it'll be kind of one giant discussion as we go. So in this section, we would like to cover reclusive behavior that's primarily a choice as opposed to a symptom or a reaction. Now, there's one of the topics that was requested that I folded into this. This is the largest section. It is a Japanese phenomenon, but they talk about so many details in here that are completely applicable to Western culture and not just quarantine behavior in the U.S., but there are pathologies and there are just simply people with preferences or who are in reaction to society or trauma or something. So the term is called hikikomori. And we are covering hikikomori in the loner by choice segment because hikikomori does not have a confirmed, distinct, known cause as of yet. And there are a lot of debates and conflicting theories as to its cause. The current predominant definitions tend to assert that hikikomori is a state that cannot be explained by another known pathology or clinical condition. Like if you actually have agoraphobia, you will see some pop culture articles that say agoraphobia is the same thing, and it's totally not. So that's the distinction that I'm trying to get you guys to understand. This is not something that is a name for something else. It's its own thing, and it's kind of a combination of things, and it's not all the things for all the people doing it. But hikikomori, a severe form of social withdrawal, has long been observed in Japan, mainly among youth and adolescents, since around the 1970s, and predominantly male, but not always, and has been especially highlighted since the late 1990s. The majority of the next section is from the wiki on this. So hikikomori, which kind of loosely translates, and pardon my Japanese if I say something stupid, I don't mean to be dumb gaijin, I'm going by what the sources tell me. Feel free to message the page and tell me if I said a dumb thing. it's supposed to translate pulling inward, being confined. In other words, acute social withdrawal is where the origin of the term comes from. They are reclusive adolescents or adults who withdraw from society and seek extreme degrees of isolation and confinement. Hikikomori refers to both the phenomenon in general and the recluses themselves. Hikikomori have been described as loners or, quote, modern-day hermits. I'll actually get into this in a later section where that's probably not the best term for that. Because hermit is actually a religious term, but I digress. We'll come back to that. The Japanese Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare defines hikikomori as a condition which the affected individuals refuse to leave their parents' house, do not work or go to school, and isolate themselves away from society and family in a single room for a period exceeding 6 months. The psychiatrist Tamaki Saito defines hikikomori as, quote, a state that has become a problem by the late 20s, and they mean age by that, that involves cooping oneself up in one's own home and not participating in society for 6 months or longer, but that does not seem to have another psychological problem as its principal source," end quote. More recently, researchers have developed more specific criteria to more accurately define hikikomori. During a diagnostic interview, trained clinicians evaluate for the following: spending most of the day and nearly every day confined to home, marked and persistent avoidance of social situations and social relationships, social withdrawal symptoms causing significant functional impairment, a duration of at least 6 months, and no apparent physical or mental etiology to account for the social withdrawal symptoms. The psychiatrist Alan Teo first characterized hikikomori in Japan as modern-day hermits, while the literary and communication scholar Flavio Rizzo similarly described hikikomori as, quote, postmodern hermits, whose solitude stems from ancestral desires for withdrawal. While the degree of the phenomenon varies on an individual basis, in the most extreme cases, some people remain in isolation for years or even decades. Often, hikikomori start out as school refusers. This is kind of a Japanese phenomenon. It's, you know, people who don't, it's not really quite truancy per se, but they just don't go. The term they use these days is futoko in Japanese. An older term for the same thing is, oh, God, Toko Kyohi, T-O, and it has an accent with a straight line across, and I don't know the name of that accent. I'm sorry, I took French. T-O-K-O-K-Y-O-H-I is the older term for this phenomenon. Common traits that they have: while many people feel the pressures of the outside world, hikikomori react by complete social withdrawal. In some more extreme cases, they isolate themselves in their bedrooms for months or years at a time. They usually have few or no friends. In interviews with current or recovering hikikomori, media reports and documentaries have captured the strong levels of psychological distress and angst felt by these individuals. While hikikomori favor indoor activities, some venture outdoors occasionally. The withdrawal from society usually starts gradually. Affected people may appear unhappy, lose their friends, become insecure and shy, and talk less. Prevalence. According to Japanese government figures released in 2010, there are 700,000 individuals living as hikikomori within Japan, with an average age of 31. Still, the numbers vary widely among experts. In fact, I think I saw a study later on that said the current numbers that are closer to 2020 actually average over a million. These include the hikikomori who are now in their 40s and have spent 20 years in isolation. This group is generally referred to as the, quote, first generation hikikomori. There is concern about their reintegration into society and what is now known as the 2030 problem, and they mean a year, when they are there in their 60s and their parents begin to die. Additionally, the government estimates that, here we go, that's where I got the number from, estimates that 1.55 million people are on the verge of becoming hikikomori. And so these would be Japanese people. Tamaki Saito, who first coined the phrase, originally estimated that there may be over 1 million hikikomori in Japan, although this was not based on national survey data. Nonetheless, considering that hikikomori adolescents are hidden away and their parents are often reluctant to talk about the problem, it's extremely difficult to gauge the number correctly. While hikikomori is mostly a Japanese phenomenon, cases have been found in the United States, the UK, Oman, Holland, Germany, Spain, Italy, India, Sweden, South Korea, and France. I'm actually going to pause here real quick since the section is so long and just check in. Dr. Mathis, is there anything that you want to talk about before we get too far down this rabbit hole?
No, we're good.
Just checking in because I know I'm going to be talking a while with this section. Alrighty, so hypotheses on the cause. First thought is psychiatric disorders. Hikikomori is similar to the social withdrawal exhibited by some people with autism spectrum disorders, a group of disorders that include Asperger syndrome, PDD-NOS, and classic autism. This has led some psychiatrists to suggest that hikikomori may be affected by autism spectrum disorders and other disorders that affect social integration, but that their disorders are altered from their typical Western presentation because of Japanese sociocultural pressures. Suwan Hara, in 2007, discovered that 5 of 27 cases of hikikomori had a high-functioning pervasive developmental disorder, HPDD, and 12 more had other disorders or mental diseases, parenthetically, 6 cases of personality disorders, 3 cases of obsessive-compulsive disorder, 2 cases of depression, 1 case of slight mental retardation, and this was used in a clinical sense. In the U.S., that term's not used a whole lot, but I digress. And 10 out of 27 had primary hikikomori. And a partridge in a pear tree. Okay. The researchers used a vignette to illustrate the difference between primary hikikomori without any obvious mental disorder and hikikomori with HPDD or other disorder. Alan Tao and colleagues conducted detailed diagnostic evaluations of 22 individuals with hikikomori and found that while the majority of cases fulfill criteria for multiple psychiatric conditions, about 1 in 5 cases were primary hikikomori. Till date, however, it is not included in the DSM-5 due to insufficient data. And this was still true up to 2018 when this was written. To the best of my knowledge, hikikomori is still not in the DSM and does not plan to be at any point soon. None of the addendum or anything like that. Is that true, Dr. Mathis? Do you know? By any chance?
Yes.
Okay, I figured, because I did try to look real quick and I couldn't find it. Okay, according to Michael Zeilenziger's book, Shutting Out the Sun, How Japan Created Its Own Lost Generation, the syndrome is more closely related to post-traumatic stress disorder. The author claimed that the hikikomori interviewed for the book had discovered independent thinking and a sense of self that the current Japanese environment could not accommodate. The syndrome also closely parallels the terms avoidant personality disorder, schizoid personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, agoraphobia, or social anxiety disorder, also known as social phobia. These are my notes here. There have been formal attempts to get hikikomori listed in the DSM-5. One such effort was a proposal, hikikomori, a Japanese culture-bound syndrome of social withdrawal, a proposal for DSM-5 by Alan Robert Tao, MD-1, and Albert C. Gaw, MD-1. And this was back in June 2010 in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease. Pardon, I still have my cough. I'm fighting. Quote, a form of severe social withdrawal called hikikomori has been frequently described in Japan and is characterized by adolescents and young adults who become recluses in their parents' homes, unable to work or go to school for months or years. The aim of this study was to review the evidence for hikikomori as a new psychiatric disorder. Electronic and manual literature searches were used to gather information on social withdrawal and hikikomori, including studies examining case definitions, epidemiology, and diagnosis. A number of recent empiric studies have emerged from Japan. The majority of such cases of hikikomori are classifiable as a variety of existing DSM-4-TR or ICD-10, the other book, psychiatric disorders. In other words, it's a case of something else that is already in there. However, a notable subset of cases with substantial psychopathology do not meet criteria for any existing psychiatric disorder. We suggest hikikomori may be considered a culture-bound syndrome and merits further international research into whether it meets accepted criteria as a new psychiatric disorder. Research diagnostic criteria for the condition are proposed, end quote. Next subset of theories as to what causes it is social and cultural influence. And we are mentioning this because there are many parallels here to similar problems in the U.S. You know, to bear in mind, some of the factors here are because it's a distinctly Japanese phenomenon, and two big things in Japanese culture. Getting mental health help is considered a source of shame. And also parents tend to look at the deeds of the children as a reflection on the whole family. So if their kids are at home needing a psychiatrist and failing to launch, they're not going to talk about it. They're going to keep that crap quiet as long as possible. So kids are not getting help, and people don't even know they're existing. They're doing that. You know, they're always studying or working so hard or some other thing. The parents will cover that up. This is something that there are, in fact, parents in the United States that have that attitude. A lot of them are greatest geners and baby boomer generation, or people who have carried on those values to the next generation. But at any rate, that's part of what's going on, and it does have an influence. But there's several parts of this that you are going to recognize as applicable to Americans as well. So there was a huge section on this in Wikipedia, and this is already kind of long. In fact, we do run the danger of maybe being a two-parter, but I'll let you guys know at the top of the hour whether that's going to be a thing. So summarizing the Wikipedia explanation, there are some social and cultural factors that could be contributing to hikikomori, many but not all of which are quintessentially Japanese. And here's an explanation of some of the things I've been telling you. They have to do with, first, the middle class being able to support an adult child at home. Low-income adults would be forced into the workplace due to lack of other options. Second, the enormous societal pressure and expectations put on youth and young adults, and many hikikomori simply being unable to meet them. Three, economic, workplace, and educational factors, where the job prospects of many young adults are precarious, even if they, quote, do all the right things. You know, if you study and you get all A's and you go to the right universities and do everything your parents say, they're still not getting meaningful jobs and pulling their own weight. And this is an enormous thing in that society. It's very contentious. And fourth, inability or unwillingness of parents to address the first signs of a reclusive adult child and head them off, preferring to live in denial and secret shame. And the last factor with hikikomori is modern technology. With the proliferation of home electronics, the internet, video games, social media, smartphones, etc., some have examined the role of technology in the uptick of hikikomori, but many studies have concluded that technology only exacerbates or at least facilitates what's already present. It might even, in some cases, keep some loners at least virtually connected to others. There have been some internet addiction behavior among some loners, and we've talked in a different episode about internet addiction behavior, by the way. But it is not thought to be a cause, but rather a symptom of the social anxiety and isolation. And that is the end of the section on hikikomori. So I'm going to pause here and see if Dr. Mathis has anything to add.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
All right, so let's get to the next part. So this is originally entitled Loner by Pathology. And as I mentioned earlier, so many of these had little column A, little column B. So these divisions are very, very loose. But in this segment, we want to discuss some mental health issues and pathologies that may contribute to or exacerbate loner behavior where it might not otherwise exist, and not necessarily hikikomori, but all different kinds of loner behavior. Some are related to apathy or focus, or you know, lack of focus, rather than issues with society or people. Not everything on this list is even a mental illness or even necessarily a negative behavior. Here are some of the most common conditions that could cause loner behavior. First, agoraphobia, which is, you know, as the name implies, a phobia, an anxiety disorder characterized by symptoms of anxiety in which the person perceives their environment to be unsafe with no easy way to escape. These situations can include open spaces, public transit, shopping centers, or simply being outside the home. Being in these situations may result in a panic attack. The symptoms occur nearly every time the situation is encountered, and last for more than 6 months. In severe cases, people may become completely unable to leave their homes. Agoraphobia is believed to be due to a combination of genetic and environmental factors. Actually, after each of these definitions, I'm going to take a quick pause in case you care to add or clean up the definition or add anything in. So is there anything that you would like to add to agoraphobia before I go to the next one?
No, I think we're good, unless you want to have a trivia as to where that comes from. the term.
If we have time, if it's not too long, yeah, sure, go ahead. Let's have it.
So it's from the Greek autothephia, which means fear of open space, fear of the marketplace.
Oh, very good.
So you're really scared to go into the Publix of Kroger. And with high prices, who can blame you? Oy.
Oh, here we go. Oh, my God. Unsaid Greek words. We're getting a doubleheader tonight. Oh, Lord.
I had to do that. Yeah.
This is 12 years ago.
Yeah, okay. Really.
Okay, so let's go to the next pathology is asociality. This is hard for me to say. It refers to the lack of motivation to engage in social interaction or preference for solitary activities. Developmental psychologists use the synonyms non-social, unsocial, or social uninterest. Asociality is distinct from, but not mutually exclusive to, antisocial behavior, in which the latter implies an active misanthropy or antagonism towards other people or the general social order. A degree of asociality is routinely observed in introverts, while extreme asociality is observed in people with a variety of clinical conditions. Asociality is not necessarily perceived as a totally negative trait by society, since asociality has been used as a way to express dissent from prevailing ideas. It is seen as a desirable trait in several mystical and monastic traditions. Pause and see if you have anything you want to add into this.
Yeah, that's a common confusion. The public sees antisocial and asocial as the same thing, that they are worlds apart. And you've accurately described the difference. And I would say asocial behavior is probably closer to the Japanese phenomenon than anything else.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And I think when a lot of Westerners are reading about hikikomori, which is part of the reason I spent so much time on it, because I didn't know what it was, and I realized we had to do a lot of cleanup for Americans. I think that's one of the biggest misunderstandings. Is that we are a society that values the individual, and Japanese society works differently. And so things mm-hmm. that are considered abhorrent or inappropriate are a little different over there. And that does enter into the pathology. You know, they're in a society where certain things are a no-no that over here wouldn't really raise an eyebrow at all.
Right.
For example,
right.
Getting mental health.
Right.
Okay.
And right. And I think it is narcissistic of us Westerners to think that somehow, you know, that's messed up, because that's just part of their society. And I'm sure they think stuff we do is kind of messed up, and it's just part of our society. So, you know,
yeah.
You can't judge people by your own standards in that regard.
Correct. And that's one reason we do point these things out, you know, so that you know.
Yep.
A lot of these things are measured by what is considered customary in
mm-hmm.
the social context.
Right,
okay.
Exactly. Yep, yep.
So the next one is avolition. As a symptom of various forms of psychopathology, is the decrease in the motivation to initiate and perform self-directed, purposeful activities. Such activities that appear to be neglected usually include routine activities, including hobbies, going to work and or school, and most notably, engaging in social activities. A person experiencing avolition may stay at home for long periods of time rather than seeking out work or peer relations. People with avolition often want to complete certain tasks but lack the ability to initiate behaviors necessary to complete them. Avolition is more commonly seen as a symptom of some other disorder, but might be considered a primary clinical disturbance of itself or a coexisting second disorder relating to disorders of diminished motivation. In 2006, avolition was defined as a negative symptom of schizophrenia by the National Institute of Mental Health and has been observed in patients with bipolar disorder as well as resulting from trauma. Pausing for Dr. Mathis, the pause that refreshes.
Usually when the bipolars are in a depression phase.
That they have avolition?
As opposed to a manic phase, because there is no avolition in them boys when they're manic. Let me tell you.
Like, oh, my God, let me clean everyone's house on the block.
Yeah, that's not a joke, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so the next term is hermit. And as I mentioned this earlier, a hermit or eremite, E-R-E-M-I-T-E, adjectival form, eremetic or hermetic, or hermitic, not to be confused with the other words, is a person who lives in seclusion. Now, hermits are a part of several sections of various religions. Despite the word being used interchangeably for loner or recluse, it is primarily a religious act, originating in those who practice, quote, a desert theology, seclusion and life of denial. And it's supposed to be mirroring Christ 40 days in the desert. You know, he goes off and is tempted and by himself and so on. It's supposed to be that life. And so the more appropriate use of the concept of hermit is supposed to be religious seclusion and giving up of things for, you know, purposes of advancing your spirituality.
Right.
Okay.
Yep,
and anything
definitely.
You want to add to that? Are we good?
No, and that's true in not just a Judeo-Christian religions, but a lot of other sects do the seclusion thing in order to give time away from distractions so you can kind of get back to your, you know, grounding, so to speak.
Yes. And in fact, I think there may be a term that comes up later where I mention this. Again, I'm just scrolling down real quick. I might have taken it out. I'm not sure. There was another term. It began with an A, and it mentioned religious seclusion in a bunch of different contexts. Now, the next one, learned helplessness. So learned helplessness is behavior exhibited by a subject after enduring repeated aversive stimuli beyond their control. It was initially thought to be caused from the subject's acceptance of their powerlessness, discontinuing attempts to escape or avoiding the aversive stimulus, even when such alternatives are unambiguously presented. Upon exhibiting such behavior, the subject was said to have acquired learned helplessness. Over the past few decades, neuroscience has provided insight into learned helplessness and shown that the original theory actually had it backwards. The brain's default state is to assume that control is not present, and the presence of, quote, helpfulness is what is actually learned. Research has shown that increased 5-HT, in other words, serotonin, activity in the dorsal, is it RAPHE, R-A-P-H-E, RAPHE nucleus?
RAPHE.
Okay, so the dorsal RAPHE nucleus plays a critical role in learned helplessness. Other key brain regions that are involved with the expression of helpless behavior include the basolateral amygdala, central nucleus of the amygdala, and bed nucleus of the stria terminalis. Activity in medial prefrontal cortex, dorsal hippocampus, septum, and hypothalamus have also been observed during states of helplessness. In humans, learned helplessness is related to the concept of self-efficacy, the individual's belief in their innate ability to achieve goals. So you can kind of see now where this is leading with withdrawing from society, because if you don't think you can accomplish anything, what do you typically do? You sit at home with your hand in your pants, Rudy Giuliani. Learned helplessness theory is the view that clinical depression and related mental illnesses may result from such real or perceived absence of control over the outcome of a situation. And I will pause here and see if Dr. Mathis has anything he wants to add, correct, or anything else. Okay.
No, cool. I'm good. You know where the original studies were done, right?
I want to say we've done the we did a show on this, didn't we? Or didn't we?
I don't remember, but it was basically shocking dogs, and then you know, they would jump to the next pen that didn't have electric shock, and then he took a bunch of dogs and shocked both sides of the pen, so no matter where they jumped, they got shocked, and they went, okay, I'm just going to hang out here.
Oh, geez. Yeah, I think we mentioned this in passing on another show, but I can't remember what it was relevant to now.
Yeah, a lot of stuff that was done back in the past, even though very helpful in some ways, would not pass scrutiny today, that's for sure, like the Zimbardo prison study, for example.
Oh, geez, so. Yeah.
Yeah, no, just saying. Okay.
Just saying. All righty, so that's learned helplessness. The next one is loner. This is another one of those words that, you know, we know what it means, kind of, but let's tighten it up a little bit. So a loner is a person who may avoid or doesn't actively seek out human interaction or relationships. There are many reasons for their solitude, intentional or otherwise. Intentional reasons include, but are not limited to, being introverted, spiritual, mystic, having religious considerations, or personal philosophy. Unintentional reasons could include being highly sensitive, shy, past trauma or events, or having various mental disorders. More than one type of loner exists, and those who meet the criteria for being called loners often actually enjoy social interaction, but display a degree of introversion which leads them to seek out time alone. Loners may simply prefer solitude or be forced into it by rejection, or lack of resources, or the means to do otherwise. And just as a heads up, it's getting very close to the top of the hour. So what we might end up doing is, after I do Recluse, we might end up pausing here and doing the remainder of the show on our next session.
I was going to suggest that.
I thought you might. Okay, so let's wrap up a show on reclusive behavior with defining the word recluse for you guys.
Yeah.
So a recluse is a person who lives in voluntary seclusion from the public and society. Historically, the word referred to a hermit's total isolation from the world, but in modern usage, it has become more inclusive. There are many potential reasons for becoming a recluse, including but not limited to a personal philosophy that may reject consumer society. A mystical religious outlook may involve becoming a hermit or an anchorite. That was the word I took out, anchorite. That was religious and very specific to the point of being a little pedantic about how many different kinds of loners we could have. A survivalist may be practicing self-sufficiency. A criminal might hide away from people to avoid detection by police. Or a misanthrope may be unable to tolerate human society. It can also be due to psychological reasons, such as being a victim of forms of abuse that can cause almost all of the following psychological disorders. Post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety disorder, apathy, autism, depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, intellectual disability, schizoid personality disorder, schizotypical personality disorder, or avoidant personality disorder. Entrepreneur Kim Smiley wrote, quote, "We live in a society that stigmatizes seclusion, yet has an almost rabid fascination with it at the exact same time," end quote. And I'm going to pause here and skip down to wrapping this up for the moment. Is there anything else that you would like to add for this evening until we come back to this next time?
So on the sidebar, I think the same fascination we have with recluses is the same fascination we have with serial killers.
Ooh. Ho, 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 ho. Maybe we should
just
go there next time. Yep.
I thought you might like that one.
Yeah. I, you know, maybe we'll talk about that over the week. You know, I might want to poke that bear.
I'm good with that. It'll be fur out.
Oh, ah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we can imagine the possibility.
Punishes us more. Okay. Okay, so that is loner behavior and reclusiveness, part one, and we will get to the rest of it next time, and we may even get into this serial killer thing. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic, which will be this part two, Wednesday, November 11th at 11 p.m. and right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow night, Travel Itch Radio, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Is it haunted or is it not? Dun, dun, dun. The historic Hotel Bethlehem has one room where guests, one or more rooms, where guests have experienced strange encounters after dark. Even Hotel General Manager Dennis Costello tempted fate by deliberately staying in the room most likely to be haunted. With Halloween approaching rapidly, Travel Itch Radio hosts the Hotel Bethlehem's Kelly Ronalds, who will talk about the legendary Pennsylvania property and its unworldly happening. Kelly sits down with longtime host Dan Schlossberg and co-host Mary Ellen Nugent Lee to talk about Halloween and other special days at her property. On Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday Morning Extravaganza. On Halloween, 10:31, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday Morning Quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. No one is safe while they troll the digital airwaves, so please join them as they discuss the latest news in the world sports, and review the events of the past week. And last but not least, I'm seeing another show. I'm Polly. The Fear the Walking Dead World Beyond online viewing party. We have a doubleheader until Thanksgiving because we have two shows run concurrently. So Sunday, November 1st, this coming Sunday, 8:30 p.m. up until 11 p.m., Fear the Walking Dead Season 6, Episode 4, and The Walking Dead World Beyond Season 1, Episode 5, back-to-back. And I'll be hosting that this Sunday night. So you guys come and join us. Please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. See you next time, and rock on. Good night.